make a start since it's 5 to 6. So we're running about 25 minutes late, which means kind of on time, I guess. Welcome to the third session of this Gender Work and the Household workshop. And I'm very pleased to be here. I'm a bit of a latecomer and a slight interloper, as I just happen to be in Mytilene at the moment, working on a slightly different project, but the topics here are very interesting to me, so I'm very, very pleased that Akis has invited me to be here. I'm also very pleased to sort of not do any more introductions other than just ask Zelmin Kaska to begin the session with her paper, and I'm not going to read it out since almost everybody this morning changed their titles. I'm not even going to dare, so I'll leave it to you.
Well, I slightly changed it. It should be, I guess, Women and Migration and Moldovan Domestic Workers in Turkey. My work actually focuses on, and my presentation today will focus on migration experiences of Moldovan women in Turkey. So I am not an expert on domestic work. My topic is basically migration, women and migration. I have been working on this topic for 4 years. The interesting thing is that we are talking about new migration movement or new migration trends. And in this new migration trends, new countries come to the scene of migration. Turkey is well known of being a migration sending country, and since the 1950s, since the mid 90s, Turkey has started to become a host country for migrants. So yes, in recent years, as I said, Turkey has become a host country. For Eastern European people from Eastern European countries and also from former Soviet Union countries. And my topic is on Moldovans. So Moldovan women migrants are, you know, searching for a better living after the transition process in their home country, which have dramatic consequences. So, in parallel to the worldwide tendencies in Turkey, most of Moldovan migrants can find employment opportunity only in domestic work. I am working on this topic, and when I draw my framework, I have in my mind three general trends or tendencies. The first one is irregular migration, the second one is feminization of migration, and the third one is globalization of domestic work. We can see all the effects of all these trends in the Turkish context. Also, when I draw my framework, I keep in my mind the change in the welfare regime, the change in the gender regime, and the change in migration regime. We know very well that there is an increasing demand for domestic work, and there is an increasing supply of domestic labor. When I think about these trends in the Turkish context, I should stress that the welfare regime in Turkey, for example, caring for children, ill people, and house cleaning are usually organized through family and informal networks. In other words, the number of formal public or private domestic service agencies is small. In this context, Moldovan women can find jobs quite easily in Turkish households. Initially, migrants from Moldova who have Gagauz ethnic origin were preferred by Turkish employers because they speak Turkish. But as demand grows, people with other ethnic origin from Moldova also started to be employed in Turkish households. Of course, I mean, when I draw my theoretical framework, I use all the new concepts as global care chain, care drain, and also brain waste. Brain waste is very important in this context because women or men from Eastern European countries or former Soviet Union countries have they are very well educated people, and when they come to work in domestic work, their professional expertise is not necessary. They are not employed because of their professional expertise. Yes. Why Turkey, one of my questions is, of course, why Turkey has become a destination country for Moldovan women. When we look at Turkish society, for example, we see that the proportion of economically active women is around 25%, quite low. On the other hand, we see a slight change in demographic structure of Turkey, which means the proportion of the elderly people is growing. So, on the other hand, I should also stress that the family is the strongest institution in Turkey, and family has too many burdens. So, the tendency to employ Moldovan domestic workers started in big cities, but now it is not just it is not limited with big cities. Even in small towns, you can see Moldovan domestic workers. But in this context, I should also stress that the need for employing a Moldovan domestic worker is not particularly related to cleaning. It is for care for the elderly. So in Turkish society, there is a socially and culturally constructed acceptance of taking care of elderly at home and by the members of the family. So for example, we have some nursing houses, of course, but nobody prefer to get the services of the nursing houses. On the other hand, why Moldovans come to Turkey? The second question, maybe. The answers are, of course, many. One of them is a geographical proximity. It is very easy to travel between Moldova and Turkey. Secondly, the role of informal sector. I mean, almost half of the Turkish economy is informal, undocumented. So it is quite easy for an irregular migrant to find opportunity for employment. And thirdly, there is an intensive commercial contacts between Moldova and Turkey, and it is known as a shuttle trade. I'll talk about this later. And fourthly, flexible visa regime. Moldovans can enter Turkey with a sticker type of visa, which can be provided at the custom, at the border, for a month. So it is quite easy to get a visa. Yeah. Hmm. Before drawing this framework, let me just talk about how Turkey in the beginning experienced of being a migration receiving country. It was, well, by the mid-90s, Turkish society is not familiar with foreign people in general, and foreign women in particular. I mean, there were some German brides, but I mean, they were in in prestigious position. But what happened in mid-90s is that Turkey has started to receive women migrants from ex-socialist countries. And there were no connection, there were no communication between those societies and Turkey in the past. So it was a kind of a sudden shock. And what happened is that, I mean, this moment started in the form of shuttle trades. People from former Soviet Union countries were buying some goods from their own country, and they were bringing here and selling, and vice versa. So it was the first encounters, if I may say. But what happened after then was that Turkish men were attracted by those women, particularly in the north cities of Turkey. And in our morning session, we talked about women women migrants organization. So in the Turkish context, what happened was that Turkish women organized or activate the NGOs in order to protect their families. They applied to the ministers, and because I mean the family is the most important and strongest institution. They just thought that there is a very important threat to this well established institution, and. Yeah, there were some divorce. On the other hand, some years after, the issue of trafficking has become a very important issue, and particularly international organizations push Turkey in order to push Turkey in order to bring some more effective measures in order to combat with the problem of trafficking. So in these two cases, it was women migrants were on the agenda, but after then we have started to receive domestic workers, but they are almost totally invisible. I mean, they are not on the agenda of the government or media or whatever. It was Natasha's, the first group, and the trafficking of women. So, last year, I conducted a research on Moldovan domestic workers in Turkey, and I conducted interviews with migrant women, their employers, and the officials from private employment agencies and travel agencies, and I also talked to Moldovan officials and Turkish officials in order to understand the work experiences and migration experiences of Moldovan women. In this context, I should talk about the relevant legal framework. I mean, what is the response of Turkish state in this to this sudden migration and flows. And in this context, two pieces of legislation are relevant. One of them regulates this citizenship. It is a very important issue for a certain time because particularly women migrants were arranging marriages of inconvenience in order to get Turkish citizenship and to have a regular status in Turkey before 2003. But the parliament changed this law and bring a new regulation by imposing a 3-year waiting period before a foreigner obtains Turkish nationality. And the second relevant piece of legislation is the law concerning work permits for foreigners. Do I have time?
No, please.
Good. This law is important for many aspects, but I should stress that it is with this law that foreigners are allowed to be employed in domestic services in Turkey. It was the first time. Before this change in legal regulation, it was almost impossible, not totally, but almost impossible for foreigners to get work permits in Turkey. But as I said in the beginning, I mean, Turkish society and also Turkish economy is a very informal one. So, for example, by the end of 2005, there are just 48 work permits were given to domestic workers, and 20 of them are Moldovans. On the other hand, when we look at the migration flows from Moldova, we see that I mean, this country is experiencing mass emigration, and they experience the transformation period very dramatically. And according to unofficial estimates, there is almost 1 million Moldovans are living abroad, and the total population of Moldova is 4.5 million. One of the important aspects of the migration flows from Moldova is that it is we see feminization of migration, and the roots for this should be sought for the challenges of the transition period in Moldova, which impacted both men and women. But the situation of women is worse than that of men. The number of women living in poverty is disproportionate to the number of men. In Moldova, 68% of the unemployed are women, despite having the same level of training as men. And when employed, their salaries in the national economy constitute just 60 or 70% of that of men. So it is basically mainly migration of women. So when we look at the migration practices of Moldovan women in Turkey, I find the concept of Morakvasic very useful. Morakvasic used the concept settled in mobility in order to describe the new migration patterns. And she argues that the emigration and immigration explanations are not valid in this new migration flows. But what settled in mobility refers to is that people migrate, people choose migration as a strategy of staying at home, which means it's a kind of in a circular migration. They go to another country, stay for a while, and then come back to their own country, stay for a while, and if there is a need, they go again. So it's a kind of strategy to stay at home. In order to stay at home, they migrate. So I really find this concept very useful for my research. So the main character of Moldovan migration to Turkey is circular, short-term, and voluntary migration movement. Of course, there are some cases of trafficking of women, but it's mainly a voluntary migration movement. They enter Turkey legally. They have valid passport and visa for 1 month. And they usually stay and work in Turkey for 5 or 6 months. And after this time, they go to Moldova for a short visit, and then they return home. In this context, I seriously think about regularization programs in other countries, mainly in southern European countries. And I am really not sure if it is a relevant solution to the case of Moldovans in Turkey, because this circular character of migration, or the flexibility of migration, is very important for them. For example, if there is a need, for example, to take care of the elderly or children, they go. If there is a funeral, they go. They can easily go. And they are replaced by their relatives or friends in Turkey. So there are, of course, you know, informal ties, informal networks. But this flexibility of migration is a kind of, you know, good opportunity for migrants. after they decide to migrate to Turkey, it seems that they don't have any serious difficulties in organizing their journeys. Apparently, there are some informal agencies in Moldova which organize the travel and which provides the visa. In their first journey, most of the Moldovan women whom I talked to were not alone. They were they had their accompanying relatives or friends with them. So from their own village, for example, so they did not experience difficulties when they were traveling. In terms of care deficit, it is of course the family members, including the fathers, who take care of children. However, it seems that because most of the women do not have very young children, because most of the Moldovan women in Turkey are in middle age, so they don't have, you know, small children. They are generally in their middle age, because middle-aged women are preferred by Turkish families in order to protect this institution. So caring for children is not a serious problem for them. In terms of their working practices, of course, the most important thing is to find a job. And here we see two important channels. One of them is private employment agencies, which are also working or operating informally. They are undocumented. And they, of course, get commission for their services. But the second channel is that the migrant women themselves develop, you know, informal networks, and it is these informal networks that they can find jobs. But the role of the private employment agencies is still important, and migrant women are aware of and make use of the services of private employment agencies, particularly when they in their first migration experience. But after then, they don't want to apply to the private employment agencies. As I said in the beginning, most of the Moldovan domestic workers are employed in care work. It means they work on a living basis. Some of them work on a live-out basis, but particularly in the beginning, they prefer to work on a living basis in order to solve the accommodation problem in Turkey. And after a while, if they have enough courage, they started to work on daily basis. Because if they work on daily basis, they can earn more money, apparently. But it means they have to rent a house, and but some of them choose this way. On the other hand, in terms of, again, their working practices, I noticed some point which is which seems to me very important, and we need to explain this. Because most of them are employed in care work, and the person that they take care of is generally a very old person, they have two employers, actually. One of them is their immediate employer, but the other one is the generally the daughter of the employer. So it is the daughter of the employer who monitors and controls the work done by her. So it is, as I said, we need to explain this. There are, of course, some disciplinary practices of employers. One of them is to take the passport of the employee, but when the Moldovan domestic workers get experience, they find a way to keep their passport with them. But in the beginning, in their first experience, they can't do it. They sent, of course, their earnings to Moldova, and their earnings are used for various purposes, such as for medical care of their family members, to pay the debts, the expenses of children's education, expenses for children's marriage, to build their house, to support their parental family, to make investment for the future, for the decoration of the house. There are various. To buy a house for children, for example, or to support their unemployed husband, and so on. The money transfer is also the most popular way of money transfer is also informal, and located in one district of Istanbul, and this district is in a sense a transnational place. In this district, there are some minibuses operating between Turkey and Moldova. So the drivers of the minibuses offered the money transfer, the service of money transfer. Of course, they charge commission for this transaction. And just like money transfer, parcels are also sent by the minibuses, and it almost depends on trust relations. I mean, you give your money to a minibus driver, and nothing happens. I mean, you can trust it, and they don't have a negative experience on this. So it is also very important. As I said, they developed networks in Turkey. They developed their own informal ties with other Moldovan women because they have relatives and friends in Istanbul. They meet each other regularly, they share their problems and spend some time together. And particularly the information particularly on work opportunities spread through these informal ties or transferred within the family or kinship groups or community members. On the other hand, when we look at their physical mobility in Turkey, particularly in Istanbul, it is very interesting because, ironically, they are mobile at the international level, but they are immobile at the local level. I mean, you cannot; they are almost invisible in the city. They have their day off on generally on Sunday, but some of them do not have courage to go out on Sunday because of their irregular status. And as I said before, there is a particular district in Istanbul, which is which functions as a transnational place, and this place is called Laleli. Their visibility, they are visible just in this particular district, not in other places. But of course, they visit the churches on not every Sunday, but at least twice in a week. I also looked at the way how do they solve their problems stemming from being irregular migrants, and also their problem stemming from being a migrant woman. But I don't have time for this. Why do Turkish employers prefer Moldovan domestic workers? I mean, it is quite common in Turkey, for example, particularly for middle-class or upper-middle-class families to employ domestic workers, but it is for cleaning, so the daily basis. Why Turkish employers prefer foreign or Moldovan women is that Turkish women, generally local women with rural origin, do not prefer to work on living basis. They want to go home. I mean, they want to work on live-out basis. So this is the most important reason. But on the other hand, of course, almost everybody thinks that Moldovan migrants are unusually well-educated. They are skilled workers. They have work discipline. But also, we should add the low wage, the factor of low wage. There are some problems which employers experience, but I don't have time to talk about this. Maybe I can turn to this point during the discussion period. But finally, I want to talk about this private employment agencies. They are actually regulating the irregularity paradoxically. They set the standards, all the standards of of the employment. They set this salary, the wage. They set the working hours. They set the day offs. Everything. So even if the Moldovan domestic worker do not find their job through the through the private employment agencies, these standards are well known. So everybody keep or follows these standards. So they, in my view, they really have a very important role. And finally, the space, how do you pronounce, I don't know how to pronounce this, the space future of the private employment agencies is very important. They usually rent an apartment flat, which has kitchen and bathroom, whatever. So the migrant women, for example, go these flat during some days to spend their days off. And on the other hand, when they are waiting to find a job, sometimes it takes 2 weeks, 3 weeks, sometimes a month, they stay in these particular places which are belong to the private employment agency. And the last thing is that the operation of private employment agencies are also very important. They usually have a partner from the sending countries. I mean, a Turkish owner and the Moldovan owner, they are working together. Otherwise, the Turkish owner of the private employment agency cannot find Moldovan migrants. Yes, I should stop here, and sorry for this bad English.
It's fine.
Very good.
Completely understandable. Thank you very much. That was a really good start. There's so much in there. I was at a workshop last week called Money, Location and Visibility, where this whole issue of remittances, there was many countries have this, and it's completely reliable. It's completely informal, undocumented transfer of money around the place, and it's hugely important. It's a very interesting aspect. And the whole business that you brought up of the ease of travelling across this border is so important to the experience of paid domestic work for transnational domestic workers, and it's very clear from what you say that is an issue. I mean, there's lots of questions I have, but we're thank you very much for that, and we're going to move on rapidly, trying to catch up some time to Dimitri Arsanoglu, is that correct? From Antigone, and again, just in case you've changed your title, I'll let you introduce your title.
You have to now.
No, I haven't changed it. I hope the presentation will cover the existing title and things that are mentioned. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for the possibility they give me to participate in this workshop, which definitely helps me to be more gender aware of migration topics. A glance at the composition of the workshop is enough. And of course, to wish a happy anniversary or happy birthday to the Department of Social Anthropology and History. As the position paper of this workshop notes, since the 1980s, the issue of paid domestic work has been a major topic of empirical research and an important area of theoretical debate in the social sciences. In addition, this topic is present in a variety of national contexts, as we have seen, thing that renders the international and comparative character of this workshop rather relevant and enriching. The thoughts that will be presented here are, in fact, some of the first outcomes or impressions of a mapping research conducted in the area of Athens in the framework of a European Indie Preparatory Actions Project entitled Integration of Female Migrant Domestic Workers, Strategies for Employment and Civic Participation. I have here some colorful leaflets, so it's a part of the dirty job of advertising. During this research, several in-depth interviews with relevant stakeholders, representatives of authorities, trade unions, NGOs, and women migrant associations have been effectuated, while study visits in Athens and Berlin, Nicosia, Barcelona, and Bologna are forthcoming, contributed to a comparative idea as far as several aspects of the theme are concerned. To begin with, I will try to give a brief overview of the phenomenon in the country. Then I will refer to examples, to some examples of strategies employed within employment and social participation, or participation in social collectivities and actions, which sometimes undermine the given structures that legislation, the type of domestic work, implies. Certainly, female domestic worker in Greece is not a figure which appeared in the early 1980s with the arrival of Filipino women, who rapidly became a sort of status symbol for upper-class households. It existed previously mainly through young women who came from their villages to the city and worked in households as figure pair. The first factor usually mentioned is the massive entrance of indigenous Greek women in the labor market. Although here there is a disparity, which I noted, among Greek and migrant interviewees, where the former deny a causal relation between female employment and domestic work supply by migrants, and the latter, the migrants, insist that migrant domestic work has significantly contributed to the growing female participation in the labor market. Another prominent factor is the lack of sufficient welfare state structures. Therefore, the needs and the demand for domestic and care services have been gradually generalized to further social strata. Class differentiations among employers remain and have to do mainly with ethnicity preferences, though valorization may change in time. For example, there seems to exist a growing preference for Albanian women, while in the beginning it was not absolutely the case, as well as with working time arrangements. To put it simply, live-ins and full-time employees can be afforded only by upper middle and upper classes. Although paid domestic work performed by migrant women shows a growing tendency among all the economically developed countries, the extension of the phenomenon remains difficult to seize. The character of the work, which is in the largest part informal, as well as the fact that many of these workers are undocumented or possess documents through other regulative pathways, such as family reunification, are the main obstacles to a complete quantitative outline. In the case of Greece, some estimate their number from 60 to 80,000, for example, the General Confederation of Labour in Greece, the largest union confederation in the country, some others at about 40,000. The only official data which could be used as a basis of estimation is the last census, the 2001 census, and the statistics of the Institution of Social Insurance, which is the fund for private sector workers and thus responsible for domestic workers' social insurance. According to the last census, where the categorization has been done by the nine main economic activities, 62,000 women, 51.8% of the total of women, were working in 2001 in services, which include other works also. Whereas for migrant men, this percentage was only 6.6. According to the social insurance statistics, 17,400 foreign women were insured in 2004 as workers in private households. It is clear that no safe estimations can be drawn. Gabriela Lazaridis, in a critical account of migration theories until the mid-1970s, was writing in 2000 about the sexist myopia that ran through previous approaches. Although migration theories have been since enriched and incorporated in diverse ways the gender dimension, migration policy doesn't seem to follow the same pattern. In fact, migration policy in Greece is characterized by two, at least, blatant contradictions. Firstly, requirements for residence permit, although they are seemingly gender blind, follow the male migrant worker paradigm, where family reunification seems to be the most plausible way of entrance for women. It is rather indicative that, according to an Albanian member of the Greek network of migrant women, 90% of migrant women obtain a residence permit as protected members of family. Secondly, the whole migration regime, strictly linked to Fordist types of labor regulations, such as contract with a particular employer, is also reality blind. since post-40s flexibility and growing informality seems to be in major part the rule for migrant and not only for migrant work. Thus, in spite of evident specificities, domestic work is incorporated in the general regulation patterns of waged work. Nevertheless, labor conditions inspection is literally impossible since workplace, in our case household, is protected by family asylum. The body of inspection cannot enter the workplace in order to check if all the working rights are respected. As the above mentioned Albanian domestic worker reported, I quote, "Behind the doors there are no rights. It depends merely on the employer, whether he or she is a good person, if you are exploited or not." Ignorance of rights, which has to do also with the continuous changes of the legislative framework. For example, the previous law of 2001 suffered 66 amendments, and the last law of 2005 already 17 amendments, changes. Isolation and exclusion are the main problems as far as workplace is concerned. Nevertheless, especially for the live-ins, which is usually the first option, organized through informal agencies, as in Turkey, for many independent, alone newcomers, household is also the first place of contact with the so-called host society. As an Ukrainian domestic worker, member of the Ukrainian Association of the Land of the Stork, allusion, as she explained, to the hope of return to the homeland, said, "Many girls learn the Greek language and the problems of the Greek society in the house by watching TV, listening to discussions of the householders about problems of the kids at school, etc. Work overload, which has to do with the lack of a formal description of specific tasks, is a very common practice. I quote, "You begin with an agreement for house cleaning and cooking, then you get laundry and ironing, and if there are children, you get also babysitting," a Moldovan domestic worker reported. The maneuvers of negotiation are far larger for the leave-outs or the freelancers who work part-time for several employers. We must note there is a huge difference between women who live in the house and those who live out and have several employers. Through informal networks of information exchange, which are based mainly on the interpersonal relations, usually within the same ethnic group, prices and tasks are somewhat standardized. Claims for and protection of rights, as well as conflicts among employers and employees, may strategically overpass the confined space of the household. A Greek interviewee who had to find a new worker to take charge of an elderly member of the family, since the Ukrainian domestic worker announced that she would return to her homeland, reported severe difficulties and finally the impossibility to do so, because the domestic worker was informing all the candidates about wage problems and work difficulties while she was still at home. There were candidates who came and she informed them. A similar tension between structural limitations and constraints on the one hand and strategies and practices from below on the other exists regarding social life and participation outside the household. Civic and in general social participation, though, which seems to gain significant space in the EU jargon as a celebrated panacea for full integration of the so-called vulnerable social groups, cannot or should not be seen as a neutral condition. Besant's notes on youth participation seem to be accurate in our case too. I quote, "If they are to enter the public sphere in its current form, they do so on an extremely unequal footing. The public sphere is not neutral in terms of age, race, socioeconomic background, or gender. Unequally powerful groups develop unequally valued styles of operating, with the result that subordinate groups are marginalized or excluded. Acknowledging inequality, rather than bracketing it, is likely to increase the possibility of arrangements being made that reduce the disparities between dominant and subordinate groups." In fact, speaking of civic participation of migrant domestic workers and of migrants in general seems ironic, if not cynical. that because the legislation context in Greece, and probably not only Greece, is far from promoting any sense of civic participation, which by definition implies a series of recognized civil rights. Thus, it would be more accurate to speak about social participation, the promotion of which can hardly be found at an official level. On the contrary, it is hindered, among others, for example, by the fact that these women do not have the time or the funds to attend even Greek language courses. There are a few state-funded schools offering such courses for free, but demand is so high that it may take years for an immigrant to be able to enroll. And here it is important about the language, because in the last law, the directive, the European directive about the long-term residence permit was transposed. But in order to gain a long-term residence permit, you have to have a sufficient knowledge of Greek language, Greek history and civilization. Or culture, civilization, I think it was culture. Additionally, married migrant women need to provide Greek authorities with proof that their marriage with a Greek man is going well, harmoniously, according to official terminology, among other documents, in order to be able to extend their residence permit. This is not valid for married migrant men. Thus, for migrant women who work in domestic services in Greece, not only participation, but even visibility is an issue. I quote, in Greece, when we speak about migrants, we always mean men migrants. Migrant woman works in a closed area where she can prove neither the labor conditions nor the exploitation. She is absolutely excluded, especially the livings. Only during the last 2 years they have begun to speak about women migrants, reported the Albanian woman mentioned above. Existing associations and communities face serious problems of sustainability, with the brilliant exception perhaps of the Filipino Association CASAPI, which was one of the founding members of the Respect Network, which is self-sustained and very active, even for working rights, and operates also a nursery school, which even Greek children of the neighborhood attend. For example, the Ukrainian association mentioned above was obliged to abandon its offices and consequently its school because of lack of economic resources. The same problem is about to come for the Greek network of migrant women, which is dependent upon EU funding through an equal program, which ends in June. Lack of resources, as well as lack of institutionalization of migrant communities, serves as an alibi for authorities in order to exclude migrants from social dialogue about migrant problems. As public officials have described during the interviews, migrant communities are rather divided, and their leadership is not widely recognized and accepted by the members of these communities. So government agencies claim that it is impossible to promote a social dialogue with migrant communities. It is important to note here that a new national action plan for the integration of migrants has been voted in January, and which says that a national council of migrant integration will be created, where six ministries, representatives of trade unions, other social actors will participate, even the Greek Orthodox Church, but not migrant communities at all. Nevertheless, despite problems and difficulties, female migrant domestic workers have timidly begun to appear in the public space. The most important example of such an invasion in the public sphere is the No to Racism from Babies Coat campaign, launched initially by the Union of African Women. This campaign, which led to a demonstration in the center of Athens last October and a concert held by groups of young musicians with migrant background during a festival organized against the demolition of the old municipal market in the district of Kypseli, in the center of Athens, refers to a grave problem faced by migrant children. Migrant children, if they were born in Greece, not only they don't obtain citizenship, another expression of the dominant view sanguinis, They don't have the right even to be registered with the municipal authorities which issue birth certificates. This causes huge bureaucratic problems, as many applications in Greece, including residence permit, which is necessary by the age of 18, require a birth certificate. I will now try to conclude with some preliminary and contradictory thoughts, which might stimulate a further discussion. Firstly, in the rich scientific and political literature and discussion on female migrant domestic workers, one could distinguish three main approaches or better ways of understanding the migrants as victims or domestic slaves approach, the migrants as women approach, and the migrants as workers approach. Each one has its implicit or explicit roots in relative standpoints and implies certain types of analysis and action to which I don't want and probably I couldn't refer in details. Nevertheless, a central question which is posed inevitably to everyone as a researcher as well as a social agent is who determines these ways of understanding. To be more precise, many of the women I spoke to, especially those from Eastern Europe, had qualifications such as chemical engineer, film technician, a specialty that does not exist in Greece, that's why I didn't understand it very well, even PhD in sociology. Certainly, in these cases, domestic work is an obvious sign of downward professional mobility. Nevertheless, at the same time, in an overall account of life trajectory, the same women seem to have experienced an upward social mobility translated into several types of investment concerning their economic and social being. Secondly, a lot of discussion has been developed about whether generalization or at least increase of domestic work reproduces gender division of labor, in other words, whether it reproduces and enforces sexist social structures and patterns inside and outside households. It is undeniable that domestic work is a largely gendered work, which keeps intact gender roles within households. On the other hand, domestic work, previously unpaid and therefore devalued, becomes more and more professionalized and consolidated as another type of work which is normally paid. As a Bulgarian domestic worker said, even when I don't feel very well, I go to work. If I stay at home, I will do the same things without being paid. It is important to note also that even if the vast majority of married migrant women obtain their residence documents as dependent members of their husbands' families, there are many cases, in Athens at least, especially after the decline of the in construction sector at the aftermath of the 2004 Olympic Games, where the sole income comes from the woman. The third point has to do with the concept of informality, which very often serves as an explanation, not only for migrant domestic work, but in general for migration in Southern Europe. It is undeniable that informal economic activities play a major role in all the Southern European economies. In Greece, they are estimated to occupy from 20 to 35% of the overall economic activities. Nevertheless, the fact that, on the one hand, the non-standard employment shows a clear tendency of growth in almost all OECD countries. For example, in the mid-1990s, it raised at 37% in UK, 30% in France, almost 40% in Italy, more than 40% in Netherlands, almost 50% in Japan and in Australia, as well as the growing economic informality connected to illegalized migration in Europe and in USA renders a very simple question rather relevant. Finally, what is formal? Maybe it is time to reconsider this formal-informal distinction, unless we want to keep on denying undeniable realities, as it happens in Germany, for example, where some millions of people simply do not exist, even in the mind of researchers, because they are not registered as normal migrants, because they do not fit in the administrative normativity. Finally, the question of integration that dominates a great deal of discussions and researches, even this one, some outcomes of which I have just presented. Here and in other research contexts, what strikes me are the multiple ways in which migrants deploy their limited social possibilities, virtualités, Henri Lefebvre might call them, materializing their relative autonomy of social action, and finally integrating themselves into the societies they live. Of course, this doesn't happen without problems, and particularly within an equal social space. Space here is in a broader sense. But in any case, an integrated social space can be, and usually, if not always, is an unequally integrated social space. So, reversing the dominant paradigm of integration, according to which migrants are called or obliged to adjust and integrate to an allegedly given host society, we should maybe reconsider whether host societies are those which should start seriously thinking to integrate to themselves. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's great. Thank you very much. Another large number of things to think about. And as you were talking, sort of bringing together many of the things that were said in the papers this morning and just a little while ago by Selmin. Three key things seem to come into this issue. One is the visibility and invisibility, mobility and immobility of these people. Another is, which is very related to it, the legal and documentation issues, and the actual bits of paper and the bureaucracy and the actual practicalities of getting through all of that paperwork, and whether it's easy or difficult, and whether it's possible or impossible, and who gets control of the bits of paper, the passports or whatever. That seems to be hugely, hugely important. And this big question of resources, that even if you are given some kind of recognition, or whether by the EU or by unions or by NGOs or by some other people, that without actually just enough money to and resources to get together and actually do something, it becomes extremely difficult, even with the best efforts like this, which sounds like a very brave effort in October, of people coming publicly saying it's not okay for our children not to have the right to stay in the same country where I stay. So it raises another series of both the political and the kind of what, and your last point, which I think is crucial, about this, what is formal and informal, basically is the question of what the state has the right to say exists and doesn't exist, or what may or may not be visible, or what may or may not, and that it's done in a legal way. And that's that really is a very big question with these sorts of issues. So I've just sort of prattled on a bit in order to give people time to think of issues they'd like to ask and question. I have a lot of questions, as I indicated this morning, but I won't abuse my position as chair. Yes, thank you.
I've got a question for Selman and one for Dimitri. I found this fascinating when you, sort of these contradictory tendencies going on, where you're saying on the one hand there's the demand for elder care, obvious demand for elder care, but you also said there was this organisation in opposition to the presence of migrant domestic workers, seemingly as a signifier of a breakdown in traditional family care relationships. And I wondered where you thought that opposition came from.
Mm-hmm. Sex worker trafficking.
So it's not domestic workers. It's not opposition to elder care as such.
No. Except by elder women, for living care,
the sex workers.
Only yeah,
sex.
I mean, so there's a different
yeah, people kind of women. You know, separate these two groups. But one of them is, of course, people who are involved in sex work.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, there are some well, honest Moldovan women who are in their middle age, and they do not involve any way to do sex work in the sex work. So there is not this kind of opposition. But in general, there is a prejudice against women coming from those countries. And on the other hand, for example, people do not differentiate their country of origin. We just say Russian. They are coming from Ukraine, Belarus, and other countries. On the other hand, there are, of course, these Central Asian countries. And most of the people living there are Muslim. So it is really a very diverse and heterogeneous situation, and there are many different groups. But Moldovans are almost totally identified with domestic work, and particularly care work. So there is no problem with a Moldovan woman who is in their, who is in her 50s, children at home. There is no problem, but there is a problem if the migrant woman is in their is young.
Yeah.
If she is young, the problems start. For example, because of the dress code. Because of the liberal dress code, I mean, Turkish society is a conservative one, so the dress code sometimes can be a very, very important problem, and for the reason for quitting the, for terminating the informal contract. So, yeah, people distinguish or separate the groups, and they prefer not to employ young women by thinking that there is a possibility of being involved in sex work.
Mm. Yeah. But it can lead, can't it? Because I mean, I don't have evidence of this, but it's anecdotal evidence in Germany, for instance, that Thai women, whatever age, the sort of blanket sort of stereotyping of Thai women as sex workers, and I just wondered if that, you know, had implications.
After a certain age, it is not the issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
Francis.
It's about the really interesting papers. I've been, heard several papers recently from people doing research on Moldova.
If you could speak up a little, I don't think.
I've heard various papers recently, so I can't look that way. from people who are researching in Moldova, and also some from people working in Turkey on the Moldovan workers. And like Annie, my impression's been that there's been this that the there's a sort of blanket identification from within Turkey that's very much connected with discourses of nation making and making boundaries and stuff. So that Natasha is a female from
Russia.
Ukraine, Moldova, in that order. Yeah. But what really interested me too is that there's that some of the in listening to people who are actually doing research on the Moldovan side, it seems to me to be very clear that particularly in areas where there's really almost complete unemployment and that's sort of economic breakdown, that you have labor chains organized from within the village, and you'll have maybe one senior woman in the village who's organizing different kinds of labor, and some of it's quite clearly designated sex work, and then some of it's domestic work. And I wondered whether, in what you're seeing from the Turkish side, whether those kinds of village associations stay active when women are working in Turkey, whether they keep those connections, and whether they keep some kind of sort of support networks. or whether it's a much wider, much less regional one, whether it becomes less personal once you get...
I think at this moment I can't answer this question because I have not been in Moldova yet.
Yeah.
But in 2 weeks' time, I'll be going to Moldova to see what's happening there.
Yeah.
What kind of informal agencies or associations are active? But it is generally I heard that there are some senior women in Moldova and giving the information and advice about Turkey, the job opportunities, about private employment agencies,
yeah.
and their recommendations are followed apparently. But
yeah.
I can't answer.
No, I was wondering from the Turkish side whether when you in your research whether there's a coherence among Moldovan workers within Turkey that allows them to talked about networks and you talked about things being of informal recruitment,
mm-hmm.
and I wondered whether they're kept alive once they go into work in the destination country,
mm-hmm.
whether they stay in close kin or neighborhood groups, whether that gives them some kind of safety net of support, or whether, in fact, they get spread out so that
no,
doesn't
no, no.
happen.
I think they just keep those ties as it is, and they develop. It is not the other way around. No.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it touches upon the previous question. Is this Moldovan migration, focusing on either sex work or domestic work, a kind of transformation of earlier forms of informal trade between
ex-Soviet?
Yeah, whether the current forms of sex work or domestic work are transformations of earlier forms of informal trade between ex-Soviet Union and Turkey.
Yeah.
Women with the street cases.
To some extent, yes, it is. On the other hand, maybe I should.
Because you mentioned Laleli and my very little knowledge of Istanbul.
Yes, Laleli is the meeting
center,
point.
So it means that there is a big. There is a historical background to this migration,
mm-hmm.
and probably this is very, very important in
contextualizing
again the role of these women today.
Of course, we don't know how many Moldovans were involved in shadow trade in the beginning of this migration route, but apparently the information about Turkey passed through those shadow traders. On the other hand, maybe I should add another point. When we look at the deportation figures, Moldovans, for example, are deported mainly for visa expiration, not because of involving in sex work, not because of sexually transmitted diseases. These two issues are very important for Turkish state. Turkish state, of course, wants to protect the public health. And on the other hand, maybe I should add another thing. Sex work is legal in Turkey for Turkish women. It is regulated by the state. It means sex workers have regular health controls. So for the state, for the Turkish state, the foreign sex workers actually threatening public health because they are not checked. Yes. It was the shuttle traders who spread the information about Turkish society. Yes.
Thank you. I think maybe this is a
I was just going to say it's nice to see the progress from this morning, where instead of the domestic work seeming to be an enclosed space, we're talking more generally about different kinds of formal and informal work,
mm-hmm.
and the links between trading and domestic work, and indeed I'm sure many other jobs. And my specific question to both of you was, in most of these jobs that we know about from different parts of the world, the people who are talked about as if they were in another class altogether, i.e. the agents or the employers,
mm-hmm.
are usually successful workers a few years on, or as I think is coming out now, they're two generations, they're the mother's generation rather than the daughter's generation. So I wonder if we could use that information to reflect back on this morning what we were talking about with change of care and change of demand and movement.
Mm-hmm.
Because in a sense you turn the inside, as it were, the domestic space into the economy. So mm-hmm. how far would you take it from your both of your materials?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know how to answer this. Well, my observation is that I don't know if it is the answer to your question, but after a certain time, after gaining sufficient experience, the Moldovan women themselves become the agency. So it is the experience, and we are talking about the experience for almost 20 years. It's quite a long period.
And they've accumulated the capital to actually invest in the business.
Exactly.
And it's not all gone back.
Yes, yeah, some of them may become the partner of the private, for example.
So it's there's mobility, social mobility too. I mean, social.
Yeah, to some extent.
Occupational.
To some extent.
For example, for domestic workers, also for cleaning services, is what Eleni told me about, that there are some subtractors.
There are cleaning agencies in Greece, and they actually employ mainly undocumented immigrants, and usually newcomers. There are about 7 of these agencies, and they take most of the public buildings and the hospitals, etc. The interesting thing is that out of 7, 4 are the heads of 4 of them are immigrants themselves, and so or some of the Greek contractors do subcontracts with immigrants who actually hire the illegal. So actually, there's a responsibility for those people lies on immigrants themselves.
Did you ask? Was that your?
No, I wanted to ask.
Because she was next in the line to ask.
No, I wanted just to. Yes. And about and I have done some research with the migrant workers in the work sites in the for the Olympic Games, and it's another sector, construction, but. There are some similarities. The 80% of the workers in the work sites were migrants, and there was a pyramidal, how can I say, structure of the work. And many of the subcontractors, and many of the subcontractors were migrants who employed other migrants.
But what's really interesting about something like the Olympics is it. Sorry.
No, yes, and this is about formal and informal again. What I want to say, in Greece, for example, sometimes informality transforms the formal way of things. What I want to say is, for example, in the legislation for domestic workers in Greece, for migrant domestic workers, there is an exception. For example, they are insured in the social insurance fund, but they can buy their social insurance contributions as a liberal profession. And this is, of course, a way of collecting money for the state, maybe, but it is also a possibility for migrants to have,
and there were two immediate interventions from Sophie.
On that question, can I add a word?
Yeah, and then after that.
I would like to add again a historian's point of view of that, because I think what is very interesting is to see how these situations, these settings existed 30 or 40 years ago among Greeks themselves. I mean, this is a duplication of known mechanisms with different nationalities. It's not a new setting. It's an adaptation of known know-how, informal mechanisms. And I think this is important to keep in mind.
Mine was a very different thing about the Olympics, because where is where you really come up across the very strongest of gendered ideologies, with these big public buildings where you allow the male construction industry to regulate itself, and all female domestic workers and sex workers are either locked up, screened, registered, you know, paper scrutinized, or zoned. So the way of dealing with gendered labor around something like the Olympics is incredibly different.
Yes, I don't speak about, I don't compare the two types of work.
But just because you wrote talk about the Olympics, in fact, how the Greeks dealt with domestic
I
work
refer
around
to the Olympics
was
because,
very different.
Because
than
the constructions
work.
For the Olympic Games was the most formal thing in this state. This is very interesting to see how informality enters the most formal regulation.
But this point is it was the same in Germany last year for the World Cup.
I'm sure.
For sex workers also.
But it's not just sex work, it's gender. I mean, it's male and female labour around informality with these big public events.
And it's presenting a public face to the nation, absolutely. So what's regulatable and what isn't, what needs to be. What has to be hidden away or just got rid of?
There was a very strange story about the stray dogs and cats in Athens over that, but I will leave that aside for now. And then finally, before we take our 15-minute break.
I wanted to ask, I heard you saying that immigrant Moldovan women are are visible only in these transnational places. I didn't catch the name of them.
Lalini.
Okay. So I was wondering, how are they visible? Can you give us an example? I mean, what is it that this is one person doing, and the other person is the other question is with regards to family reunification and the law. I think that it's quite interesting how the provisions, the provisions that the law states are sort of giving the opportunity, obviously, to domestic workers to buy their own way to legality. Most women opt out for being legalized through their husbands, but I was wondering how this affects marriage relations, because obviously if you're married to someone who's the source of your legalization, well, how can you get a divorce? How can you get, it appears like a rational choice. Yes, we will save money because I won't have to pay, because I don't know if you know that, but the fee for legalization in Greece is huge. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, we will save money. But also, at the end of the day, this means reinstating dependency of Greek women, of migrant women to their husbands, something which might have been challenged, let's say, by the fact that they are earning more money. Sometimes, or as you said, for example, if legality depends on your husband, but you earn more money, the law somehow pushes you towards being with him because he will provide legality. Yeah.
And there is another option, of course, to be legal. Many.
Yes.
That's why we don't know how many are documented, and not because it is not a stable condition. Many people go out to illegality, it depends. A Bulgarian, for example, a domestic worker, she told me, I buy my social insurance contribution, but it is not, that's unfair, it's not profitable for me. So I think I won't renew my residence permit.
So, can I make a small intervention here?
Yeah. There was also.
I want to tell something about the reunification. This is something who comes from the state, and it's the micro level and all this. But in the micro level, there are other things that happen. What I know from Albanian women is that the majority of Albanian men who came to Estia did not, for a lot of reasons, they did not want their women to come here. It was Albanian women who insisted and came here. So it's not that it's a sort of dependency. It was their decision, women's decision to come here, and they forced their men to do this. And a lot of came illegally.
But it doesn't have to do with the decision to come here. It's what happens once they get here.
It's what Dimitri says, that, that it don't matter for them to be illegally again. A lot of them came illegally, and they don't. It's not a very big problem for them to be again illegally.
I mean, just a point, because perhaps this point would not be possible to be raised in the next sessions, and I'll just put it to Dimitris, but if we can have some comparative reflections on that, that would be nice. I don't know the issue. It has to do with regulation and state intervention and the setting of the legal framework and the institutional framework concerning generally getting legalization, and particularly in relation to domestic work, of course. Is there any sense of a kind of comparative scale or a degree of more strict disciplinary regimes or regulatory regimes or not on a comparative level? I mean, and can we put within this comparative scale the Greek case? I mean, is it right to think that in Greece, first of all, there is this kind of lack of legal superstructure or infrastructure, whatever, to deal with this matter, and therefore it leaves much room for maneuver for, you know, individual agents? And does the Greek case makes a huge contrast, let's say, with the Asian states, for example, I mean, Taiwan or Malaysia, where, I mean, if we look at the similar literature, we find out that there are, I mean, amazing things happening, again, comparatively speaking. And I'm putting this question to everybody, I mean, just...
It's a very interesting point.
Yes,
I think that there is a much discussion in Greece and maybe in Southern Europe in general about the incompetence of the administration, etc., this incompetence argument. But I think that maybe the Southern European migration regime is the most productive regime existing in Europe now. For example, I can compare with Germany. We were there and we made a study visit, spoke with people from authorities, NGOs, communities, etc. It was striking that migrant domestic workers do not exist. I mean, the only do not exist, the only source of knowledge is the households. There have been some researches on households who occupy, but at a political level or as an issue, it does not exist. They speak about asylum claimers, refugees, etc., but illegal migration, because there has never been a regularization process, they simply do not exist. But what I find, if we compare, there are two kind of ideologies here, two kind of administrative stated ideologies. The super powerful administration ideology in Germany, which does not accept what comes out of the normativity, and the incompetence ideology in Greece, where I think the non-regulation is the regulation of... and in my opinion, for example, in Greece there has been a migration policy, very precise, and it hasn't been a product of the hazard of the... It was, in fact, this keeping a labor force without certain rights, keeping fitted with the informal sectors of economy.
Am I right to say that this is a minority view in terms of the literature and the wider debate on the subject?
No,
it doesn't. I mean, French in relation to Greece. I'm not speaking.
I think that in the States, for example, for some, in other in Europe, there are.
Yeah, but I think if you look at, you know, the Sopemi reports, OECD reports on an annual basis, Greece has always been upfront about this in its reporting, saying, you know, We recognise this is a dual economy.
We don't hear.
Oh, sorry. No, I'm saying that it is one that is actually, if you look at the commentaries on a year-by-year basis for Greece in the Sopemi, the continuous reporting system from OECD, there's always been an honesty, actually, in the reporters from Greece about a dual economy, a dual market. One for Greek nationals and one for foreigners. So I don't think it's something that isn't, I mean, maybe the politicians aren't saying it, but the migration reporters acknowledge it.
But can I say something to add to what you just said, that the major issue with resident permits is delays. The problem is once you get your resident permits, it's already off.
It expired.
It has already expired. So this has been. I mean, other people have written about that. But it's actually strategic. I mean, it's obviously strategic. You can't say this is for since 1991. They couldn't have a mechanism to impose residence permits that do not expire the time people get them. This is strategic. I mean, there's no question, I think, about that. I mean, you keep these people constantly in a precarious state.
Institutional precariousness.
Yes, exactly. And I think I don't know if it's a minority view, but it's gaining credibility, I think.
Right. And this is the meaning of the term, that it's very productive. Okay, that's the meaning of productivity.
Economically, yeah, okay. Very, very productive.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to have to stop and take a little break.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll get a chance to intervene. Will it be very quick, because we're already running over half an hour late?
So my question is regarding precariousness. As she said, there's like a condition of precariousness, uncertainty. Has the dimension of transnationalism comes in this context?
Does the dimension of transnationalism come in the...
Yes, both being here and both being there, to be more secure.
Well, in relation to the question of precariousness?
Yes.
It's, yeah, you, I think. And you.
Transnational dimension, you mean the transnational mobility?
Yes, mobility both being here and both being here and there. From where they come from, they come here also.
Is the precariousness generated in both places, I think?
I don't understand the...
Are you asking...
If the fact that there is growing transnational mobility and not a settlement, it is a factor that, in fact, enforces this institutional precariousness, the difficulty to regulate the... I don't know. I don't know that we should search for a cause and effect relationship between this. For example, transnational mobility maybe has to do with institutional precariousness, or I don't know what. I mean, if it is difficult to get a residence permit, for example, in the early 90s in Greece, we had a million of deportations of Albanian citizens, only Albanian, a million of deportations. What does that mean? That they were deported and they were coming back. This is also, it was a sort of productivity. I remember the film, The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada, where the one patrolman asks the other, how many got in though? Three of them. Someone has got to pick the strawberries. It is a very nice illustration of the border regime.
Yeah.
both in Northern Europe, America, and
we think we really will have to stop now for about 10 minutes, for just a 10-minute break, because we're running more than half an hour late now. And,